Should we jump right in?
Let's do it.
Welcome to the Hackaday podcast. My name is Mike Stish. I'm editor-in-chief of Hackaday.
Hi, and I'm Elliot Williams. I'm managing editor of Hackaday.
This is episode 6 of the Hackaday podcast. Today we'll be talking about reversing iPod screens, hot isotopes, wheel of parts, and biometric toilet seats. So, Elliot, what's going on this week with you?
Man, it's been a random week of hacking for me. It's funny, there was an interesting article by Roger Cheng about people throwing away stuff and will it make an unreasonably awesome bounty for people in thrift stores? And I don't know if that's what's going on here, but I found some space mice in eBay. And a space mouse is a late 90s, I guess, 6 degree of freedom mouse-like device. They're used for like 3D CAD stuff. And the ones I found are the super old ones that work on a serial protocol, which has advantages and disadvantages. The disadvantage is because it's a serial mouse, you can't plug it into anything these days. The advantage is because it's not USB and because it is serial, it's dead easy to interface with microcontrollers and then reinterpret it's 6 degrees of freedom to be whatever you want and then feed that in by your own USB controller. So that's my plan for it. At $5 each for something that used to be like $600 back in the day, I couldn't resist. So I picked up two. I might even have to do a teardown. We'll see if a Hackaday article comes out of this.
Oh, definitely do a teardown. I remember those. Those were super cool and super unobtainium when I was that age. But I do like the thought of great old hardware hitting the market and finding, you know, someone that's going to love it and cherish it like you will in this case. I'm actually working for Monday on a feature of one of the SuperCon talks that is recently ready for the video to be published. Adam McCombs did a great hacker's prep for what you need to know about electron microscopy. And the thing that really strikes me about this is these were relegated to only research laboratories for the longest time. And now, you know, I've seen several people on the internet that have gotten their hands on these and are doing all kinds of hacks to keep them running and keep them calibrated and do some really fun stuff with what probably shouldn't be an individual person's tool, but has become that because of the secondhand market.
We had a lot of time to talk together after that talk, and he's moved something like 18 electron microscopes now. He is probably the world's leading expert in hacker electron microscope rehabilitation, and I actually want to get him to write up his experiences with all that for us.
It's crazy to think about the specialty of moving things. I have a friend who works at the public library here in town, and our local branch is moving actually twice this year. They're having a new space built for them. And I was talking to my friend. I'm like, oh, how has it been moving? And he said, we had a library moving company come in and help us. And I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, all they do is go around the country moving libraries from one space to another.
Yeah, books are heavy and fragile is my guess. not like an old electron microscope, is it?
It might have been MIT. I was touring somewhere a couple years ago, and they were saying they have an old electron microscope that is free to a good home if you come and move it.
Yeah, we picked one up at my old hackerspace. It's really a good thing to do because the 80s tech is not all that different from the 2000s tech, except that the 2000s tech stuff has more complicated electronics in it. But the actual electron microscope part is virtually the same. And so in terms of hackability, the old ones are easier to work on. And in terms of availability, they're just being thrown out on the loading docks of science institutions everywhere. So pick them up.
Very cool. Well, I look forward to that teardown of your air mouse.
Yeah, we'll see how. Space mouse, please, sir. What's up with you?
Well, big news is I am headed to China in March. Can you believe it?
Super jealous.
So there is a huge event called Electronica China, and one of Supply Frame's companies in China called Bomb to Buy has a booth there, and they're doing some meetups with the community of EE Focus, which is an engineering community in China. I'm going to go check that out and then swing by Shenzhen, since it's relatively close compared to the trip to get to Shanghai in the first place. I believe Seed Studios is having a meetup that week, so I'm going to go down and check that out. And then Hackaday writer Sean Boyce lives in Ho Chi Minh City and has said, if you're ever in the area, look me up. And it's only a couple hour flight from Shenzhen, so I'm going to swing by Vietnam on the way home.
Super.
It's going to be incredible. So the thing that I am looking for from the Hackaday podcast listeners is, if you had one day in any of these places, Shanghai, Shenzhen, or Ho Chi Minh City, what would you do? Looking for suggestions. I am absolutely 100% going to ride the maglev train in Shanghai. Yeah, it goes between the airport and the new International Expo Center. It cost something like $1.2 billion to build. It only has two stations, and it goes back and forth between those stations. I looked it up, and I believe you can get a ticket for $7.50 US,
super,
which is crazy. And it travels 431 kilometers per hour, which is 268 miles per hour. So it'll go 30 kilometers in a very low number of minutes.
It's 0 seconds. Do they actually run it that fast in daily use, or do they throttle down a little bit to save some wear and tear?
Yeah, so in one direction, they run it a little slower, but in the other direction, it does get up to max speed.
No way.
I know, right?
That's so crazy.
How could you not do this?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I'm looking for the kind of, you know, obviously, Shenzhen has electronics markets. I'll probably end up there looking for some stuff. You know, that's pretty easy stuff to think of, but I'm looking for geek culture stuff. So I had heard that there was a big VR cafe scene in Shanghai, but I haven't. That might have been a few years ago, and I'm not sure it's as big anymore. But if you're listening and you have an idea of, you know, something geeky to do, people that we should track down in those cities, food we should eat, architecture, infrastructure. Oh, speaking of architecture, have you heard of the Lucky Knot Bridge? So this is on my list of things to see in China going back a couple years. So when I found out about this trip, I looked it up. And unfortunately, it's in Changsha,
yeah,
which is about 1,000 kilometers away from where I'm going to be. So I can't just go see it, but it's a really cool bridge. And so I'm just looking for stuff that's unique to this area and would be fun to share with the Hackaday audience. If you have suggestions, hit us up at editor@hackaday.com, or of course, we'd love it when you leave comments in the show notes on hackaday.com.
Sounds good.
Yeah, the logistics of figuring out what to do and where to go are daunting right now.
Don't worry about that. Sprite will take you there.
Yeah, actually, I'm going to meet up with Sprite TM. He works at Espressif and lives in Shanghai, so hopefully he'll take me to some fun places to eat. And then I'm hoping to meet up with our friend Scotty Allen in Shenzhen,
super.
And then, of course, if you've been following Sean Boyce's articles, like where he went around Ho Chi Minh City and tested out coffee from as many coffee shops as possible to see if it was chemically altered, I believe I will be riding on the back of Sean's scooter at some point.
Super.
All right. So if you're unfamiliar with the flow of the show, after we get past our what's new section, we generally move into great hacks, things that we thought were really interesting from places all across the internet. We talk about some quick hacks, things that are worth dropping in, and close off with articles you can't miss, some of the longer form articles that Hackaday writers have been producing and are a delight to read and should be read by all. So what's on your great hacks list, Elliot?
Let's see. This week, starting off, I have to say, hats off again to Mike Harrison. He put out a video where he dissects an old iPod display. It's called Putting an Out-of-Work iPod Display to Good Use. And the video itself is about an hour long. It's all about him going through and reversing these digital signals out of this display because he doesn't have a full data sheet for it, and he can't get it without signing an NDA and paying a ton of money. And so he's like, I'll just figure it out myself. And he does find limited data sheets and is able to get some handle on things, which gives him a start. But then after that, he is all on his own in figuring out the protocol. And the video just works through how he does all of this. There are tips in there about using your scope smartly. There are tips in there about figuring out which side of a line is being driven by which device, so whether it's the display driving it or whether it's the microcontroller driving it. There's all sorts of stuff here. He has tremendous patience. He has this rig that he builds to basically get the signals out of the display while they're being sent. And he solders about 5 wires and says it took him 2 hours to do it because they're these super tiny little wires. And he has to scrape off the, you know, scrape off the protective coating on PCB traces. Turns out to be the easiest way to get access to these lines. And then has to like flux and solder and hope. And then flux and solder and hope. And he goes back over this. And if you see these parts, they're, the traces are super tiny. So it's a miracle he was able to do it at all.
Yeah, I was looking at that part of it and I was wondering if there'd be a possible way to heat the wire to the point that it would just melt whatever solder might be on those traces.
To melt through the solder mask or?
No, you would need to have the traces already be tinned.
Okay, so tin the traces and then?
And then heat the wire. So the wire is as hot as your soldering iron. And then it would just tack on as soon as it touches the trace.
Oh, you just hope to melt in that way.
Right. That's what I'm saying is doing it without the soldering iron because it's so small.
Heat the little bit of wire. Yeah. Maybe. It might be worth a try.
I could never do it. You have to be Mike Harrison to pull off something like that. But it came to mind.
Yeah. The thing I really learned from this section was not that it sucks to solder small things, but that he mounted everything down to a custom-made frame to make this test rig. And this is something that I never do, and I frankly always regret, is once you get these tiny little wires soldered down, then you move it once, and they come loose, and then the whole thing's broken, and you have to suffer through that frustration again. What he does here is he starts off by taking what looks like a little piece of plastic and some chunks of wood, and he's zip tied and heat hot glued and otherwise affixed everything rock solid to this test rig. And he actually spends a few minutes going through some other test rigs that he's built. And first you make sure everything's immobilized, and then you start making the connections between the two. And that's just absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, so ultimately Mike shows up in the comments of this article, which is featuring a hack that he did 5 years ago and is certainly amazing to this day. But he, because it's been so long since that happened now, the job that he was working on is actually complete. And he shows off this astounding wall full of these iPod Nano screens. And they're all mounted. He's designed circuit boards that attach and take the data from screen to screen. And it's a beautiful piece of engineering up close, and then you get away from it and realize it's a giant display with lenses in front of each screen and just really an incredible piece of work.
Yeah, the piece of art that it ends up in is really awesome. But I'm not even done with the technical gold in this video yet. Like, we've moved on to the art, and I totally appreciate it. And I'm really not sure whether I like the end product better or the getting there better, but he has so many other tricks in this video. You absolutely need to see it.
Definitely. So every week, Elliot and I rush to see who can be the first one to put up an agenda for the podcast so we get to claim the best hacks that we want to talk about. Elliot beat me to this one, but this would have been on the top of my hacks you have to see this week as well.
All right. So what have you got this week?
Well, you know my proclivity for things that sort other things. Did you see the one called "This Light Up Sorter is a Bright Idea"?
I did.
So did you know I was going to pick this one because I love these?
I didn't. I was going to pick it because I like robot arms.
So this is a fantastic robot arm. I believe you call these SCARA arms.
Yeah,
is that right?
Yep.
Yeah, so it how do you describe this? It is a turret and it rotates like the face of a clock, but then it has two other joints that rotate along, you know, that hand in a clock. So it's like an articulated clock hand. And half of the clock face is a white sheet of something that might be acrylic or Delrin, not too thick. And it's a light box. So underneath it, it blasts the surface with light. And you can put nuts, bolts, and washers on the top of it. It'll blast that light and take a picture with a camera from the top and then use a computer vision, OpenCV, in order to identify what the objects are and where they are. And then it uses a little hack together electromagnet to pick up each of these pieces of hardware and put them into sorting bins.
I really liked the video for that because it showed it working, but it also showed it not working a couple times. And some people in the comments wrote snarky things about, don't you know when you're doing a demo video, you keep shooting until the one time it gets it all right, and then that's the take you use. But I was happy to see it not quite get all of them exactly right. When you see that it has a couple opportunities to get tweaked and get better like that, it just makes you want to work on it even more. And so I'm sure that this is not the last we've seen of the light up sorter.
Yeah, I mean, I think the sorting, the identification and the sorting both work really well. The error mode that I saw was sometimes they wouldn't actually drop into the bin. They'd get caught up on the edge.
Exactly.
Which feels like an easy fix. So I say total win on this one. It does, to me, look like a first prototype, but it also looks too finished to be a first prototype. It's made out of laser-cut plywood, and it's just delightful. I love it.
Yeah, I thought it was really cool.
Well done, and congratulations to Adrian R., who's the hacker that built this one. So, the dreaded buzzword IoT is up next, Elliot.
It's not so bad. Next is, toilet seat could save your ass. And this was a fantastic medical product, actually. I don't know, product, hack, experiment. Brian McAvoy wrote the article, and he put a few puns. I was going to say every pun he could think of to do with ass and butts in there, but he didn't actually. There were only three or four. The actual title of the paper that it links to is In-Home Cardiovascular Monitoring System for Heart Failure. Wah, wah. No fun. doctors, yo. But what it is putting sensors into a toilet seat because it's a place that you expose your skin to frequently on a daily basis. And they put an electrocardiogram, a ballistocardiogram, which I'll talk about in a sec, and a photoplethysmogram, which is a blood oximeter. It's a blood oxygen monitor. And so it's bouncing light into your skin and catching the reflected light and comparing, I guess it's IR versus visible light to figure out how much oxygen's in your blood in your butt. And a ballistocardiogram is the one I had to look up. It turns out that when your heart beats, your body actually shakes a little bit. And the amount your body shakes depends on the flow of blood through your heart. And so you can measure people hopping, you know, just their weight changes periodically with their heartbeat as they sit on this toilet seat. And it gives you an indication of the amount of blood pumped every time their heart pumps because, you know, it lifts you up that much when it hits the top of your aorta. And I thought that was A, really awesome. It's almost unfathomable to me that you can measure this. The medical paper that this comes from actually compared all of these three measurements with kind of gold standard medical procedures, and they were all kind of within 2%, 3%. So they're getting extraordinarily good results for these three measures of heart health from you sitting on a toilet seat. So this, you know, we had a lot of fun with it because it's funny, but it's actually a totally serious medical device, and I really like that. The one caveat is that the people using the device in the test were not allowed to urinate or defecate during the readings because they were afraid that that would falsify them. So it may be that if you want to use this for medical purposes, you have to sit still for a few seconds. But all in all, the patient burden on this is so low. You're going to sit there with your skin exposed anyway that it's, I think it's an absolutely brilliant device.
See, if you need to sit there and wait before you go to the bathroom, it gamifies it. You can put that the tree of lights that they have for drag racing, where you have the red, red, yellow, yellow, green, and that lets you know, okay, you can go now. You've waited long enough.
If I'm reading something interesting, I just sit there for another 10 minutes anyway. It's not a problem. It's like, I don't think this is an issue.
You know, this is really brilliant. I mean, he's absolutely right that this is the one thing that your skin definitely touches every single day. And there's a ton of room to build things into these seats. These seats are big, and there's really nothing to get in the way of their functionality when it comes to adding electronics to them. You could easily pour a resin seat around this, all of this hardware, if you wanted to. Very cool.
I think there's a buttload of possibilities.
Oh,
yeah, I had to at least once. What's your next hack, Mike?
So I've got a crash course in 3D printed Venturi pumps. And I've heard of these pumps before. I haven't really looked into them that much. And so this gave me an excuse to look a little bit deeper into them. Basically, it is a T-shaped pipe. And if you want to pump something out of a vessel or pump vacuum out of a vessel, into a vessel, if you want to make a vessel have
vacuum. I don't
vacuum
know which way a vacuum goes. Stuff goes out, makes a vacuum. Yeah.
So you put it on the part of the T that is not going straight through, and then you pump something straight through the pipe, and it pulls along with it whatever's in that T. This may not be a good graphical description, but take a look at this article that was written by Tom Nardi, and you'll definitely get it. So Tuval Bendoza wanted to build one of these pumps in order to remove chlorine gas that is produced when etching circuit boards at home. Cool, right?
Yeah, no, it's a super cute idea. The model he ends up printing is just beautiful.
Yeah, it's got really nice shapes, and it's he ended up making a deep dive into hydrodynamics, fluid dynamics, that'd be what you say, because he started with some shapes that were made to pump liquids, and they just didn't work because he's trying to pump gases, and ended up going through a lot of different iterations and came out with a working print that does exactly what he wants.
Yeah, I've seen them used, pumped with water to evacuate air in chemistry labs all the time. It's a classic of the advanced high school chem lab. You should have one of these. I think you use them for drying all sorts of everything or sucking water out of something you're trying to draw through a filter.
Maybe sucking the vacuum out of your home scanning electron microscope.
Exactly. But these are all driven with water. And so he's trying to drive his with air. And I think that does make it a lot more complicated because air is compressible. And so I think that makes the pressure difference when he has to neck it down a little bit harder to get.
Yeah, the thought is if you're driving your pump with a squirrel cage fan and what you're pumping is caustic, it will eat that fan away. I know that I didn't really understand the problem of leaving cupric chloride around in your shop until all of my drill bits and driver bits were rusty.
Close the bottles, Mike.
Yeah. Well, I think I was being very safe in reusing a peanut butter jar, and that lid didn't have a gasket in it. And so don't worry. I've upgraded to IKEA enclosures now for my cupric chloride. But also the tin of acetone that I had next to it is completely rusty on the top of it as well, which is probably not a good thing. So look at your home chemistry setup and become safer. Use something like this. So this is kind of citizen science-y, and I think, Elliot, don't you have a citizen science hack for this week?
Yeah, let's keep the science ball rolling. I wanted to cover spectrometer is inexpensive and capable. One, mostly because I love citizen science projects. Two, my dad was a biologist, and one of the first toys I had was an old spectrophotometer that was kicked out of the lab, and got to play with these as a kid, and they make lots of pretty colors. So I have a weakness for them. And three, I want a spectrophotometer now. So I'm going to try to make one following this design. The other thing you need to know about this is a video about making a DIY nano drop. And a nanodrop is an expensive piece of lab equipment that measures the spectrum that goes through a tiny little sample of water or whatever liquid you've gotten there. And by analyzing what wavelengths of light go through and what don't, you can tell what's in it or how far a reaction's gone or a whole bunch of useful chemistry things. So spectrophotometer is pretty cool. This is a DIY version. You should go check out the original link. I'll put it in the show notes. This was a design made by the Hacteria folks, and they've done a crazy ton of kind of open hacky bio and chemistry equipment. That's definitely worth checking out their work. The parts you need to make a DIY nano drop are actually tremendously simple. It's basically a webcam, a good mirror, a white LED, and a diffraction grating that you can get online. And then the quality of the results you get out of this depend on how well you can calibrate the webcam. In the video, he calibrates where the lines hit by using a couple lasers of known wavelength. And I think that's actually extraordinarily clever because that'll give you two or three reference points. You know, maybe you have a red laser kicking around, maybe a green one. That'll give you a couple different reference points with very sharp peaks. So when it spreads this rainbow out, the question is, at exactly what frequency is this red here? And if you have a red laser with a precisely known wavelength, you can calibrate that down pretty well. The software takes care of the rest. Did you see this one? Do you like spectrophotometry as much as I do?
Oh, who doesn't love spectrophotometry, Elliot? No, the truth is I read this one. I didn't watch the video yet. So I think you have to watch the video to understand this. There's a little bit of summary from the Hackaday coverage, but it goes deep and I just haven't put the time in yet.
Yeah, and if you're not a video type, the Hackteria webpage is really good for that too.
Oh, was that on there? Was that linked in the article? I don't see it. I think you're going to have to go and make an update there.
Hold on. I'll just put it in the comments my damn self. Hackteria. Uh-oh. Yep. All right, will do. It'll be there by the time you hear this podcast.
All right. Well, I wanted to finish up with an incredible museum installation. This is at the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry. It is an entire wall that looks like it's covered in wood panels, but those panels are actually transparent to the LEDs behind them. And when you turn it on, it's a huge LED display. One of the things that I really, really like about this is the size. It is 24 feet wide by 14 feet high and has a resolution of 408 pixels wide by 220 pixels tall. So Thomas, who was on the team that created this, mentions that that's not quite VGA resolution, but it does not matter at all.
Those are gigantic pixels.
Yeah, it's incredible. Also, I thought I saw a number of 90,000. Yeah, there's 90,000 pixels. So there's 132 APA 102 LED panels that are each made of strips totaling 680 pixels in the panel. 300 square feet of these.
Oh my God. And this is all handmade naturally?
So it's not handmade, actually. I guess it is. They had a manufacturing supply company make the panels for them. Uh-huh. So they just put out a spec for the panels. And if you look at it, it's discrete strips. And then, I don't know, maybe 20 of them. And then there are strips that go perpendicular to those at either end that make the bus connections. So I'm guessing what this factory did is design flexible PCB that would be the right spacing for that and had a bunch of spools of that printed up and then went in and manually soldered them. I don't know if you could solder it by robot or not. Maybe if you had the right fixture and you trained the robot. What do you think about that?
Sounds like a crazy amount of work for people to do, but it's quite possible. All depends on the budget, right?
Yeah, right. Well, the finish of this, if you look at it, there's some pictures of just three of the panels installed, and it looks like wood, and I thought it was wood. Dan Maloney actually left a comment on the Hackaday.io project page that says, hey, what kind of wood veneer did you use? And Thomas got in there and said, we tried a bunch of different types of veneer, but we were having problems with it washing out all the color. And so we ended up going with, this is an interesting thing that I had to look up, First Surface Graphic / Wood Print on 1/4 inch Milkplex. But the interesting thing to look at when you see this picture is behind these three panels that are hung, every one of those smaller panels, there's must be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, either 8 or 10 of those behind each of these sheets of acrylic. Those are the APA panels that make up the display. Now, of course, when you're driving this many LEDs, the question becomes, how do you feed all those pixels and what do you feed it with? Answer is,
wait, this is a trick question. You said it was less than VGA. It's not going to be all that bad.
I don't know, man. The APA's APA 102 is basically SPI, right?
Right, right. So you have to clock all these pixels through. Okay, go give it to me. The answer is?
Well, what would you use? What's your go-to? FPGA, right?
Sure.
Yeah, so it's an FPGA.
Is that the answer? Woohoo!
Yeah, that is the answer. It's actually the name of the project, HDMI to FPGA to APA 102.
Ah, boo, it's the obvious answer. Good for them.
No, I like it being the obvious answer. This is an excellent blueprint for you because what they did, the smartest thing they did is the setup uses an HDMI input. So you can feed it with whatever source that you want and it'll do the scaling for you.
Oh, that's actually really cool.
Yeah, and it's just, I think it's 4 FPGA boards. Yeah, 4 Spartan 6 Mojo FPGAs that drive the entire thing. So really cool project. Also, they're playing Donkey Kong on it. You can't go wrong with that.
All right, here we go. Hold on to your chairs. It's time for the lightning round. Here goes Quick Hacks. What have you got up?
All right, so I'm a sucker for not using proper tools to program microcontrollers. Actually, some people wouldn't say an IDE is a proper tool, but I like to program with text editor and command line and just by typing make. And there was an article this week called A Teeny IDE for Your AT-Teeny Projects. And it is what it sounds like. It's basically a little text editor, and it gives you a few menu options to do the compiling and programming. No bells, no whistles. Check it out. I think it's fun. Simple hand tools turn brass and steel into an amazing astrolabe. So if you're a regular listener to the show, you know I'm a sucker for hand tools and also for metalwork, and this is the best of both worlds. I think the point where this really stole my heart is when you see the curved grid being etched into the brass plate that is the base of this thing. And I just saw him, the artisan, doing that, and it stole my heart. So check this one out. You will love it. And the last quick link for me is how to make bisected pine cones look great step by step. And it's exactly what it sounds like. It's cones from trees, pine cones. And they're being encapsulated in resin, which is all the rage these days. I see a ton of different projects, making tables with the resin inlay and that sort of thing. But what's interesting here is after encapsulating the pine cone in the resin, they cut it in half and polish it. So you get to see it from a perspective that you don't normally see. Now, the process here is pretty interesting. It's if you're familiar with resin casting, it's nothing new. First of all, you want to dry out the pine cones in order to not have any problems when you put them in the resin. Then they actually dip them in resin to give them a coating first off. And once that coating is set, then they put them in a mold and fill it with resin and then hit it with a vacuum chamber to get all of the bubbles out. And it's surreal, the results that they get. And it could be used on just about anything. All right, you're up, Elliot. Give us the quick ones.
All right, quick hacks. I got creating coherent sound beams easily. I picked this one because it was much easier than I thought it would be. Basically, it's an array of ultrasonic transducers. They're all driven with the same signal, and that makes a basically directional beam of ultrasonic sound. This ultrasonic carrier at whatever it was, 40 kilohertz, 24, I can't remember, probably 40 kilohertz, was modulated with audio so that when those waves hit you or they hit a wall or they hit whatever, it demodulates and you get to hear the sound. So this makes a sound beam. It's an old technology. I got all caught up in the beam steering thing, which is what you would do if you wanted to point the beam around electronically by using the different phases of them, which means you have to have a separate driver for each transducer, which means you have to have 50 different drivers, and that's a pain in the butt. This project makes an end run around that, and the driver is a motor driver, and it's driven, the whole modulation scheme takes place on a 555 timer. So this is a dead easy hack that has a really cool effect, and so I love that. Next up on my list is a little FPV bot keeps it simple with an ESP32. This is a second robot by Max K, whose other robot, ZeroBot, has a Pi Zero inside of it. Both of them have cameras. Both of them are just an absolutely beautiful piece of 3D printed frame and case that I think everyone who sees this one thinks that they're just the cutest robots they've ever seen. If you have a 3D printer, you can look at this and say, oh my God, it's four or five parts. I could do that in a weekend, which makes both of these robots super high up on my little amusing robots for my son list. And finally, this 3D printed LED softbox really shines. I liked it because the result was phenomenal. It's a great directional, broadly spread out LED softbox. Makes beautiful pictures. There was no reason to 3D print this, but he took it to the extreme. There's a big box that's printed out of this thing, and he's printed lovely dovetail joints into the two parts of this box because they wouldn't fit on the print bed. I would have just made the box out of wood. But this is a fantastic 3D print. The diffuser for this is done with white and then translucent and then white filament again. So it's a multi-filament print. In making the diffuser for this, Nicholas Sherlock discovered that the regular patterns of normal infill were too regular and wanted something more random and diffusive. And so he invented his own infill pattern, which is this super random infill that diffuses the light even better. This is a tour de force of 3D printing, and it gets some phenomenal results out. And that wraps up my quick hacks. Let's get to the articles that our writers have written that you can't miss this week.
So I really loved Dan's article on the deep space energy crisis could soon be over. Did you know there was a deep space energy crisis, Elliot?
I didn't.
I didn't either, but it's a fascinating story. So I think most people listening will know that we send out spacecraft with what amount to nuclear batteries in them. I think the most information I found on this was from Andy Weir's book called The Martian, where he sends Mark Watney, the main character, out to dig up the RTG, which has something very hot in it, literally radioactive, creating heat, and then that heat is turned into electricity, and it's basically a battery that will never deplete itself, or at least on human scales will never deplete itself. We had been making little pellets. We, as in the NASA program in the United States, had been making little pellets of PU-238, which I just like saying because it's PU, but it's of course plutonium-238, which is an isotope that in pellet form glows red.
Yeah, because it's hot, yo.
It's very hot. It's a byproduct of producing weapons, and we've been doing a lot less of that throughout the world, and so it became a hot commodity. another heat pun. And to the point that we couldn't produce enough for the probes that we wanted to send out. And I wish I had Brian Benchoff's insight on this. When we were talking about this on a pitch meeting, Brian mentioned that that's why one of the probes orbiting a planet or going past a planet right now is solar powered, because they didn't have enough of this isotope. Do you remember what probe that was, Elliot?
Cassini.
Was it Cassini?
Do not hold me to that.
So the really, really interesting thing for me is the last section of this article goes through a brief history of producing this stuff and talks about how in 2015, Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Tennessee started producing this by laboriously packing together these little pellets by hand. And they weren't plutonium yet. They were actually NP. What is NP? It's neptunium.
Okay.
Neptunium-237 pellets. So they were putting aluminum powder and neptunium-237 together, and then they were bombarding them with neutrinos to turn them into plutonium-238. Apparently, and it's all hush-hush because, you know, these are secretive manufacturing techniques, but apparently there is a robot now that can pack the pellets together in a much faster and hopefully safer method.
Yeah, one thing I learned from, not from this, but from talking to Dan about the article, actually, I don't know if you've seen like those old space probes, but if you think about like Voyager space probe, there's always this long arm with a little something out on the end of it. I always assumed it was like a radio antenna or something. But it's not. That's where they put the radioactive stuff. it's way out on the end of this long arm, because otherwise it would mess with the electronics that's inside the space probe. So all the space probes from this era have one like extraneously long appendage, and out at the end of that is a chunk of plutonium glowing and producing electricity. Who knew?
Yeah, I like hearing stories about this production. I really think that the use of nuclear energy could be a short-term fix to help get us out of some of the worst parts of our global warming problems. Of course, you get into that not in my backyard problem of what do you do with the waste? And the fact that this is a waste material in itself makes me think that there are clever uses and ways that we could handle some of that problem.
I'm living in Germany, which is anti-nuke central. But at the same time, they're tremendous like eco-freaks. And it's hard to imagine these two being compatible with each other, because nuclear power, aside from the storage of nuclear waste bit, is so incredibly environmentally clean and CO2 neutral and et cetera, et cetera.
It's interesting that you mentioned that Germany is really anti-nuclear energy, because isn't your neighbor France doing a ton of nuclear projects?
Yeah, France is tremendously, overwhelmingly nuclear powered. I think they're probably the leading user of nuclear power in the world. I wouldn't be surprised. They also have tremendously cheap electricity. It's like a quarter of the price per kilowatt hour that it is here in Germany.
Yeah, and then I even heard one of the efforts that Bill Gates is undergoing right now is to challenge the government in the United States that if they adopt more nuclear power programs, that he can promise funding for them, which I think is an interesting power play. And of course, great art by Jo Kim. Again, we get the gas pump with Supreme, and right next to Supreme is plutonium, and currently out of use.
Can't
so check out the great Jo Kim art. We love you, Joe. Thank you so much for all that you do.
Exactly.
And that's mine for the day. I think the last one, Elliot, you have a deep love for, because you claimed it at the end of last week.
Yeah, I read this article first over the weekend. It's called 8 Years of Part Making, A Love Story for Parts. And this is Josh Vasquez's experience basically coming out of college and going into post-college work with a robotics firm about being the guy who makes the parts. And it perfectly captures his personal passion for being a hacker and getting stuff done with whatever you've got on hand. And it's interspersed with a bunch of his personal anecdotes and preferences for doing things one way. I don't know. We ran some previous articles of his where he professes his love for Delrin, because it's a plastic that you can cut easily on a laser cutter, but it's also extremely durable. And the only real problem with it is how you glue things to it, because it's extraordinarily slippery. And so I think he even wrote a full-length original content piece on how to adhere things to Delrin once back in the day. So Josh really cares about this.
So he's got to be one of the leading experts on working on fabricating with Delrin, right?
I have no idea. He's certainly in my friends, or in my circle of friends, he's definitely the person who knows the most about making robots out of Delrin.
Well, as a Delrin aside, you have to go look at this article and find the place. There's an image that he captioned, I reinvented the wheel once.
Yeah.
And I just looked at this, and he has made a wheel. He's made a tire on a wheel by taking thread and putting it through holes in the Delrin that he laser cut, and then looping it over the edge of the wheel, and it holds down a little strip of rubber. And so he has concentric rubber loops all along the outside of this wheel making the tire. It's shock absorber and grip in one. Very interesting.
Exactly. Some of these techniques he comes up with in typical hacker fashion were kind of invention. No, necessity is the mother of invention. These were the tools he had on hand and he needed to get something done. And so you see him doing like machine shop like operations with acrylic and things like this, because it's what he had. Mostly what I really loved about this piece was that what comes across is I know Josh, and what comes across in this is his absolute love for making awesome, crazy, mechanical things. And in fact, I think the last two Hackaday Super Conferences, he's run a workshop where he makes mechanical tentacle arms. And I've seen him lead these workshops, and I've seen the people coming out of them, and everybody loves them. And it's because you get this kind of organic-looking, quasi-robotic thing out at the end by laboriously cutting and assembling and putting together pieces of, surprise, surprise, Delrin. and so I guess what I really loved most about this article is that Josh's enthusiasm for being a hacker and building robotics and machines that move really just comes through, and it shows his voice. And if you knew him, you would say, yeah, that's exactly him, when you read the article. And so many people in the comments responded similarly.
Mm-hmm.
One of the comments, I got done reading it and I was going to actually type in, you know, I love this article. And the second response was, I love this story. So I was like, yeah, I don't need to post that comment.
Well, Josh spends a lot of time talking about the vocabulary of mechanical engineering and that you can't work with these parts until you have a way to name these parts. And I get that. There's just this library of knowledge that gets unlocked each time a new concept has a moniker.
Yeah. And this is basically him summing up kind of 8 years of doing this. And, you know, you develop your own idiosyncratic ways of working, and he's done his. And it's just so nice to see.
Yeah, he pitched this as a two-part series, so I think there is another part to come.
Ooh, fantastic. Can't wait.
Yeah, we'll keep a lookout for that.
Can't wait.
All right, friends. Well, we have come to a close of yet another Hackaday podcast. Thank you for being with us for episode 6. If you have any questions about the show or want to get in contact with us, you can always reach us at editors@hackaday.com. And as always, we'd love it if you left a comment in the show notes on Hackaday. See you next time.
Keep on hacking.
Is that good?
That's beautiful.
Marvelous. Are we ready to press stop?